Thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about causal sets at this meeting. I'll begin with a brief review of causal sets, mainly to highlight what's different about them. We've heard a lot about local structures in all of the lectures so far, local things which you can manipulate. And a very key feature of this approach to quantum gravity is that discreteness is taken to be fundamental. And that, along with Lorentz invariance, which is an outcome of the theory, results in a non-locality. And that non-locality is sort of the big boogeyman that you have to deal with whenever you're doing causal sets. So I'll then go on to describing the kind of observables that you can define. It's actually quite straightforward once you know how to do it. And this is what we call the causal set kinematics, and then on to the main part of the talk, which is the causal set dynamics, a particular way in which we can do an analytic continuation without violating the Lorentzian structure of the causal set, and the specific example of 2D causal set theory, which we've explored now quite extensively, which has a phase transition. We've studied the Hartle-Hawking wave function, and very recently, we just put out a paper on the net, done a very extensive finite size scaling, which perhaps puts the older results in slightly firmer footing. And finally, the summary in future directions, and these are sort of the papers that I'll have the references at the end of the talk. So very quickly, the causal set approach, the causal set hypothesis, is based on two fundamental building blocks. The first is the causal structure poset. Okay, what do I mean by that? Give me a spacetime, a Lorentzian spacetime, and strip it of everything but the events, as well as the order relation on the events. Okay, so strip it of everything, just the ordering structure, causal ordering. That object is a partially ordered set in a spacetime which has no closed time-like curves. So put in the condition of causality, and by a partially ordered set, you simply mean that there's no it's acyclic, so there's no closed time-like causal curves. Also, it's transitive, which means if x precedes y and y precedes z, then x precedes z. It's as simple as that. It's a very simple object. It's partially ordered because there are elements that are not ordered. They're not related to each other, and they're the space-like events. Okay. And the important thing, which I think very few people appreciate, is that it's only signature minus plus plus plus, which means one time, that has this structure. If you had a two-time signature, then that doesn't have a causal structure poset. So it's a very significant piece of a Lorentzian spacetime. The second ingredient is spacetime discreteness, which is the assumption of a fundamental spacetime discreteness where the number of spacetime, a finite spacetime volume contains only a finite number of these events. Okay? So this is an Alexandrov interval. So in that spacetime volume, you have only a finite number of spacetime elements. Okay? So that's a hypothesis of fundamental discreteness. So we take away the continuum manifold, we replace it by partially ordered sets, posets, which are locally finite in the sense that there's a finite number of elements for every space-time region. Okay, so that's the fundamental object that we're going to be looking at. Okay, there's a very deep motivation from this, which comes from Lorentzian geometry, and these are these results due to Hawking, King, McCarthy, and Malament, an old theorem, where it was part of this whole trying to understand Lorentzian spacetime from the perspective of just the causal structure, axiomatically framing geometry in terms of the causal structure. And in the process of doing that, they asked the question, well, if I look at Lorentzian spacetime, if I just looked at the causal structure, how much information does it have about the spacetime? It turns out that if you put in very mild causality conditions, that it in fact contains most of the information. It contains all the conformal structure, plus the missing ingredient is simply the volume, the local volume element. So the causal structure, which is again intrinsic and very special to the Lorentzian signature metrics, contains most of the information about the space-time. The only missing ingredient is a volume. So what is the causal set hypothesis then, given this backdrop of this Lorentzian result in Lorentzian geometry, is that you have causal structure, it gives you a partially ordered set. The missing ingredient, which is a volume element, you put in the hypothesis of discreteness. So volume is replaced by number. Okay? So in other words, what you have is order plus number, which is the slogan of CST, gives you, in an approximate sense, continuum space-time geometry. Okay? It's order and number. And then, of course, the question is, how would you interpret the continuum? How would you get a continuum out of just this partially ordered set? And so part of the hypothesis is also what you mean by a continuum approximation. If you try to do a very regular discretization of space-time, then this number-to-volume correspondence that is very important would not hold any longer, because we know that under boosts, for example, if you had a light cone lattice under boost, you could have something that's very sparsely populated suddenly become very densely populated if you had a regular lattice. The only way out of this is to think of a random lattice, and this is the kind of thing that goes back to, even in the Riemannian context, T.D. Lee, trying to understand how symmetries can be recovered by doing a discretization, and the idea is to use a random lattice. In this case, we're not using symmetry as the input, but in fact comes as an output of the theory. So here's an example of a random lattice, and we use a Poisson process to generate the random lattice. And in the importantly, in the Poisson sprinkling, you have the number to volume correspondence that is satisfied approximately. Okay, so I'm. And the outcome of this, like I said, is that you do get local Lorentz invariants. There are no preferred directions. But the flip side of this, if you like, is the fact that with discreteness plus Lorentz invariants, you've now got a problem that the theory's got non-locality in it. And what do I mean by that? I don't mean violation of causality of any of that or any of that. I mean that if I have this discrete structure and I have an event, say in Minkowski spacetime, and I ask what are the nearest neighbors? We've all talked about Ising model, dynamical triangulations, where you have a finite number of finite connectivity, finite valency for every point. But here, if you look at the nearest neighbors, because of the non-compactness of the Lorentz group, you're going to have an infinite number of nearest neighbors in Minkowski spacetime. They're all within a Planck length of hyperboloid of the light cone. Right. So it's essentially non-local as a result. And this non-compactness gives rise to a layered structure, and I'm going to go over this layered structure a little bit because it'll feature in the dynamics. And so we have the nearest neighbor, so you think of that point out. Oh, I think I should use. Okay, now I'll just stick to this, and I can beat anyone who disagrees with me. Okay, there's a point there, and I have the backward light cone, and I have the first layer, which is a set of nearest neighbors, which are these links, which means there's nothing intervening between them. Then I have the second layer, which is once removed from this. Okay. And so this is not in the second layer. This one is. It's once removed. So this pair of intervals has just one element in between. And now the twice removed can come in different ways. You have one with two elements like this and one where the two elements are, in fact, related to each other. Okay? So there's a layered structure that's there, inherent in this kind of discretization. Okay, so I can quickly go over that. Okay, so
how do you count the links?
So these two are just once removed, because if I look at the interval, the space-time interval, you know, the intersection of the future and the past of that point, then I believe the way I've drawn it, there's only one point here.
Yes.
Yeah? And similarly for this guy here. And now for one here, I think if you, yeah, that's right. There's only two in the middle. And here as well, there's only two in the middle.
Okay, so it's not the number of links you have to pass through, but the number of points that sit.
So it's a volume, the volume of the interval. Yeah, this of the causal diamond. So you're counting that. Okay, so these actually are very essential, these intervals. And counting them turns out to be very, very important. So now, of course, we want to, because that's the whole purpose of this conference here, is to try to see what we can do with this on the computer. And the important thing here is that if I had a local graph, then, and I have n points in that local graph, n vertices, then because of the connectivity, if there's a valency of k, then I just have k times n. But here, because everything is non-local, I have n into n minus 1 upon 2 number of possible relations. So I have a much larger set. Okay. So the non-locality means a much greater amount of complexity. And not all relations are born equal. It's not enough for me to just say what the relation is, whether the points are related or not. Are they related as nearest neighbors, next to nearest neighbors, and so on and so forth. And all of them could matter. So it actually increases the complexity of these things a lot. I can come back to the slide if there are more questions later, but basically the causal set, because of all of this information, has a very small causal set can contain a lot of information. Okay, so that's. So here's a quiz for you, and the answer is hidden in the rest of the talk, so in case you don't fall asleep, then you might get the answer. I had to sort of keep in mind that this is a school, so I was trying to put in my little bit of. So causal set kinematics, or how to define interesting covariant observables. One big advantage of this approach is because we have something that's basically a finite space-time. So a finite space-time region, we can define covariant observables very simply. In a causal set, covariance just means label invariance. So we don't want things to matter where something is. It's only the causal relations that should matter. It shouldn't matter how I've labeled the causal set. Okay? So it's very simple. But it's part of a larger goal of trying to get geometry purely out of the order theoretic structure. So I just have order, and I don't have triangulation and the mathematics of triangulation to help me get there. Okay? So a lot of effort that's gone on in the community has been to extract geometry out of just order theoretic structure. Okay? So there are all these various things that we can write down. And the one that's most important to us is this action, which was written down in 2009-2010. And that allows us then to write down a dynamics. But we can use that dynamics to calculate things, any one of these observables. Okay, so even here in the kinematics, analytic results, much of this was done analytically. And of course, then you look at the large n limit. But practically speaking, on the computer, then you want to know, you want to simulate it to see how large does n have to be in order to get geometry out of order. Okay, and so those are also, so a lot of numerical simulations have been done as well, so the computer is very useful for that. And for that, in particular, we use David Rideout's Cactus Causal Set Toolkit. Many of us have relied solely on that, and I just want to acknowledge his contribution to this. So how do we construct a continuum-inspired dynamics for causal sets? As we've seen so far, what you want to do is you want to write down a partition function and take a sum over whatever objects you want to and take the exponential of the action, I times the action, and that's where you start from. Now, let's begin with this action, which I've already referred to, which is the Benincasa-Dauker action. It's the discrete Einstein-Hilbert action for a causal set. It can't be obtained. It's not related to because of the fact that this is not a triangulation. It can't be obtained just by, you can't refer to things in Reggie triangulation to get the action. So this actually was quite a bit of, very important bit of work. And how you construct it, I will have an explicit example later, but just bear with me now, I'll just say it in words, that what you're doing is you're summing over how many neighboring pairs they are, nearest neighbor pairs, okay? How many nearest neighbor pairs in the causal set? How many next to nearest neighbor pairs? How many next to nearest neighbor pairs, and so on and so forth? You're just counting, okay? You're going to just count that and stick it in a particular way, in an alternating sum, and what you will get is the discrete version of the Einstein-Hilbert action, which means that these intervals and all of that information hidden in those in that layered structure contains curvature information. Okay, this is really the important part. Yeah. So we use a Benincasa-Dauker action, and omega then is some sample space of causal sets chosen in any which way you want to. But now we want to put this on the computer. How do we do that? We want to do an analytic continuation of some sort. A Wick rotation is out of the question because causal structure can't be made Riemannian, right? So we want to retain the nature of the causal structure. There's no Riemannian causal structure, as I emphasized, and nor of any other signature. So what you do is you insert, and this is what we do in all of these simulations, we insert a parameter there, which is like a fake inverse temperature, and we analytically continue that parameter. So we go from a quantum partition function to a statistical partition function, but the sample space is unchanged, which means that we're really doing a statistical geometry, but it's of Lorentzian statistical geometry. We haven't changed the nature and the Lorentzian character of the objects that we're summing over. The sample space that we have can be chosen in any which way. The reason for me to draw, the reason I decided to draw this graph is to emphasize that because we've got a fundamental discreteness in the theory, we're not interested in the continuum limit. Okay? We like large volume limits, but the continuum limit is irrelevant to the theory. So for example, the things that are not relevant to a causal set are things that are going to happen at scales much smaller than the cutoff scale. So the cutoff scale is a fundamental discreteness cutoff that you have, and anything below that is irrelevant. So in other words, if you had the space of all causal sets and you have continuum spacetimes, we're not interested in all of these that have scales or structure much below the cutoff scale. They're not relevant to causal set. In between here are those continuum spacetimes which are approximations of a causal set. Right? This also, in terms of interpretation, this makes a difference. So you can now choose in the space of causal sets to do many things. You can restrict it to the size n, which we've seen restricting to volume is something that you did in spin forms. The volume, you know, fixing V is one option that you have, and we'll fix the number of elements. But you can also do further restrictions, and I will talk about one particular one, which we've examined in detail, which is a two-dimensional restriction. And here we start off with the two-dimensional Benincasa-Dauker action. And here is the explicit form of this, where we are now summing over such links, so all possible links that are there in the causal set, all possible three-element intervals. This is what you call an order interval, an order interval, which is three-element, and you look for all such things, and you also look for two-element order intervals, and so on and so forth, and you look at all possible ones that you can construct. And they come with two things. One is this new scale that you introduce, which is a mesoscale. And the mesoscale, you can think of it as a practical as a practical necessity, because you want to, when you are recovering the action, you find that the fluctuations are really huge. And to suppress fluctuations, kinematically suppress fluctuations, you introduce the scale. But it turns out to be an interesting scale to be playing with, and it sort of plays the role of a coupling constant, if you like. And this function has this funny form, which sort of basically tells you, it's a smearing function, which tells you the first few layers are smeared over, and then the second few layers get the same sign, and the next few layers get the next sign. So that's sort of you're smearing over the layers, and the smearing is basically a way to dampen fluctuations. Okay, so this is just the form of the action. And the sample space that you have, like I said, you can restrict by the number of elements. Okay, so we're only looking at n element causal sets. But now we do a further restriction, and it's actually possible in two dimensions. And the further restriction is simply given by this object called a two-dimensional order. And it works really well in two dimensions. When you change this to higher dimensions, you get cubical light cones, so you don't want that. In two dimensions, square light cones are, in fact, conical. So, and the 2D linear orders, it's based on the following way. You take a set of n elements, 1 to n, S, a base set, and you now think of U and V as a light cone coordinates, okay? So think of a grid, a patch of Minkowski spacetime, yeah, like this. So think of a grid like this, and U coordinates and V coordinates like that. And now, you take all the list, you've got a set of points in here, and you take the set of all U coordinates and the set of all V coordinates. And the U coordinates are all linearly ordered. One comes before the next, comes before the next, comes before the next, right? I mean, it's completely, totally ordered. The V coordinates are also simultaneously ordered. What you do to construct the Pose set is to take the intersection of these two orders, and here's an example of that. You have x, and it has a value, it has a u coordinate, and a y has a u coordinate, and both the u coordinate and the v coordinate of x is less than the u coordinate and the v coordinate of y. Okay, so y is before, x is before y. Yes? Yeah? And similarly for z, but between y and z, although the u coordinate of y is greater than the u coordinate of z, that's not the case for their v coordinates. So therefore, they're just space-like related. It's a very simple way to extract out a two-dimensional causal set. And in this particular case, the order theoretic dimension actually coincides with the space-time dimension. So several examples of this, and one of the important examples is that when you pick these randomly, the u and the v coordinates, randomly and independently, okay, you pick some sequence of u's and some sequence of v's, then what you get is something called a 2D random order. And it turns out that these 2D random orders are precisely continuum approximations of flat spacetime. Okay? That's precisely flat spacetime. So 2D orders. And it turns out that in this particular limited sample space, they dominate the partition function, the uniform measure partition function. So without an action, they just dominate. So they're the nice guys. Okay? And that's the set we're going to... So they just, you know, they just dominate the uniform distribution over 2D orders. Okay? So in...
But what is a 2D order when you don't get the
No, you have the u and v coordinates, but you have many that don't look... Yeah, so here's an example of a 2D order, which is not manifold-like. Just n elements that are unrelated. That's a 2D order as well. It doesn't look anything like a manifold or the chain. And there's many examples you can draw which are not like manifolds. These are just coming from... You're using the space-time as a strut, so to speak, in order to get things out. But they include things that are not like manifolds.
But these are not the elements in your partition function, because you're saying that they have u and v coordinates on top of them.
No, they don't. Yeah. The uniform distribution, so I'm going to list the set of all possible U and Vs, all possible 2D orders. So 2D orders include things like this. Yeah, I'm just using that as a way to describe it. As, I mean, you can write it without putting it in space-time, but that's a convenient way of thinking about it. It's an intuitive way of thinking about it, but they're completely well-defined without referring to any space-time.
Can I ask a question differently? I mean, if you have two causal sets with the same ordering but different values for U and V, then you consider them to be the same one?
No, so in this, yes. So you would, in principle, are you asking when I calculate the, when I say that these are dominating?
Yes.
In that case, it doesn't really matter, just as it didn't matter to you that you were actually labeling or not labeling, but these are the dominant orders. If you label them, you would also, they would also dominate. If you don't label them, they're also going to dominate. Yeah. I mean, just in terms of what they... But you can ask me that maybe in more detail later. I just have limited time and I want to, yeah, sorry, but, okay. So, all right, so now let's get to business and say, well, what can we do? How can we generate this on the computer? And this is something explicitly for students to sort of look at and say, well, this is something you can do. So we start off with some particular choice of U's and V's. Okay, 1 to N in some combination. And I pick a pair, UI and VI, and UJ and VJ at random. Then I pick either U or V. Okay, I can pick either U or V and then exchange. So here I've just taken U exchange with UJ. Okay. And what I get is my new configuration. And here's an example, a very simple one, which is I start off with U and V being ordered in the same way, which means that what I get is a totally ordered set. They're basically just going to give me a chain. Yeah? And now I exchange U2 and U3. So what you see will happen is that now these two are being exchanged, 3 and 2 are being exchanged, the U coordinates, right? So that means that they are no longer going to be causally related to each other, these elements, and you move to such a configuration. Okay? So if you want, you can just look at a very small sample space of like 5-element causal sets and do this. In fact, here's some homework. This is really easy to do, and that's why I would encourage you to try it out, is that you just start off with either the chain or the anti-chain. Anti-chain is basically the set of all unrelated elements, and all I've done here then is to take V and ordered it the opposite direction. And so then they're completely unrelated, these elements. So I can start off with either of these two configurations and just use a standard Metropolis Hastings algorithm to run a Monte Carlo simulations. And if you did it with 20 elements, it would run very quickly. It doesn't take much time at all. Okay, it's really easy to do, and I can help anyone out with it. And in the beta going to zero limit, so without any action, you should be able to reproduce the random 2D order, which is just flat space-time. Okay, so when we put this on the computer, we check for detail balance, you use all of this, you have very good thermalization. And what we found some years ago was that there's, in fact, a phase transition. If you look, I mean, I'll have this graph later. If you look at the average action as a function of beta, then there is a phase transition that happens. And you get two phases. The first is this, which is a continuum phase, continuum-like phase. And the other is a completely different non-manifold-like phase. It's a very unexpected phase. We now understand why it's coming. But this is the other phase. And we could actually find, we tracked all possible observables, and we found that the phase transition was robust. When you varied over observables, you still get a phase transition. The same system, you can now try to construct a Hartle-Hawking wave function, which basically what you're doing is you're saying, in the causal set, there's not geometric information is derived. So the one thing that you have, in lieu of a final hypersurface, is just an anti-chain or a set of unrelated elements of a certain number, you can construct a Hartle-Hawking wave function. And there, when you look at it, you find, again, a very surprising behavior that's emerging, which is that the wave function has a very defined and definite peak, which shifts sort of very drastically. So this is going through the phase transition, and it shifts over to another peak. And essentially what it is that the peaks are, it is peaked over geometries that are continuum-like and peaked over geometries in the two phases. And it's not as trivial as it looks, because in fact it relates to how the critical point, or the I should call it the temperature of the phase transition, changes as a function of the number of final elements. So there's something non-trivial there.
But,
pardon? Yeah, so now we're doing, so that's the next, so that's my next set of slides. But of course, these results are for small n. We had did them for for n equals 50. So the guy that I showed you here, and that's the answer that this one here, which was the quiz. So now at least hopefully everybody paid attention. So this is a continuum. So this is flat space-time. And you can actually, this, even though it looks like, oh, there are just 15 elements here, okay, all right, 50 squared upon 2, that's not a lot to tell you about flat space-time, but you can go and check many of the geometric indicators. You can check for dimension, you get 2. You can check for the order intervals. These, like I said, the distribution of how many of these next to nearest neighbor elements there are. And all of these are you know, strongly indicate that what you have is flat space-time. Okay, so a very small patch of it, but it's flat space-time. So, of course, we didn't, yeah.
So beta was like sort of a fake parameter that you put in by hand just to make it look like a partition function. So why is it relevant that there's a phase transition with respect to this parameter?
That's a very good question. And I think we don't understand. I mean, one of the things that I think is part of the larger questions that all of us have to ask is, we do some kind of an analytic continuation, right? We go to things which are computable. We go from a quantum partition function to a statistical partition function. And often we don't really know how to get back. And I think this is a question that's there, valid for a lot of our. And so I agree, that is a very big question. In the phases, the one thing you might think, so in the phase diagram that I showed with the beta squared versus epsilon, one of the things that one could interpret this to say is that because beta squared is on this axis, this corresponds to the analytic continuation. So although you can't go there, you have the continuum phase here. You are maybe and perhaps justified in saying that the continuum phase, there's a continuum phase that's there even for beta squared less than zero. But that's as far as I can go, and that's as far as I understand. The only thing I'll say that in the Hartle-Hawking wave function, because of the way you define it is as a Euclidean, as a statistical, I mean, we interpret it in a bit different way, but it's a statistical partition wave function. So, I mean, in the sense that there's no imaginary part to the. So you can then say that beta, maybe beta is a parameter that in some fundamental theory will play some role. We don't know. So that's a good question. So what puts practical limits on the size of the causal set? It's really non-locality. And that's really our big boogeyman. Importantly, so here's each sweep that we have, which means that in. So I think that Gerard was telling us about what a sweep is. You have to go through the entire set. In the case of the Ising model, you do it. You have to do n steps, where n is L squared, yeah, in the 2D Ising model. But here, because of the fact that every pair things count pairwise, you have to make sure you scan pairwise. So it's already n squared upon 2 for every sweep, yeah, and so it already implies longer thermalization time, yeah? But the other thing is that the non-local action, you see in the Ising model, you can do a local move and then update the action locally, right? The update is a trivial update. It's very easy. But here you have to, if you remove a link, It's like collapsing a pack of cards or a house of cards. All of a sudden, everything is totally different. The two configurations are actually, they can actually be very different because the action now will have to be calculated all over again. So improving that calculation is a big deal, and it turns out that Will here, sitting at the back, tells me right now that he's used this thing that Eric referred to the other day, which he put in red, which is out of control order, or out of order control, sorry. Shouldn't reverse the order of that. Apparently, if you use the computer architecture more carefully, you can, in fact, get around and try to do bigger ones. So I'm waiting to hear about that from him. The Metropolis algorithm works perfectly fine, but anything more complicated, like the cluster algorithm, which we learned about yesterday, is much more complicated because, again, the non-locality messes up the updating of the energy. Okay. So really, then, we have to ask, why would we, and as people have asked, why should we believe any of this stuff for such a small n? Where do we? And so the important thing, as we've learned all of these days, is finite size scaling. How do things converge with n? So where is the asymptotic regime? And we have to remember at all times, however, that I'm not interested in the continuum limit. I'm interested in the thermodynamic limit to see if there's convergence. Even if you give me a two-element causal set, that's fine with me. There's nothing, no problem with that, because that's a fundamentally discrete theory of two Planck units. Okay, that's fine. I don't have to go to the continuum limit. Nevertheless, I'm still interested in the thermodynamic limit, and that's what I will. Importantly, this action that we have is not extensive. It doesn't scale with n in a simple way. So all of these issues, and the non-locality gives rise to long-range order. So when you study, instead of Ising model, you study, for example, gravitational systems or electromagnetic systems on a lattice, the long-range interaction changes the phase structure considerably. So there's a whole, the whole paradigm of all of this is highly affected when you suddenly increase long-range order, increase the interactions to be long range. So what we did was we looked at how what will happen as we vary n. And this is work with Lisa and Dinjo. It's there in my earlier reference. I didn't put it in here. And what you find is that this phase transition, as you change n from n equals 30 to 70, seems to really suggest very strongly a scaling behavior. And in fact, we find amazing collapses. We're able to collapse. So here, this is the epsilon values that we've looked at. And we're able to, first of all, redefine the bare temperature that we had into a scale-independent temperature, inverse temperature. So it goes like beta n. That's the scale-invariant quantity. And when you do that, the critical temperature, the temperature of the phase transition collapses in all of these cases to one point. And that's this curve here. Okay, and we can now, therefore, in a scale invariant way, for any n, we can tell you what beta critical is. Okay, so give me an n and an epsilon value. I'll tell you what beta critical is. And interestingly, in the first phase, which I was loosely calling a continuum phase, if you do the analysis carefully, you find that S is proportional to the size of, so it's in fact the average value of S, the expectation value, is extensive. And if you sit back and think about it, what does it mean? Because all of the other parameters, the dimension seems to come out still to be 2, and the scale, so it's very strongly indicative of a negative cosmological constant. Negative because the slope of this curve is negative. And we did further checks on this. We still have more checks to do to make sure that what we're saying is correct. But we have checked with all our continuum prescriptions, and we strongly suspect that what we have is a cosmological constant. So the first phase, even though you start off with flat space-time, as you crank up beta, you actually begin to develop a small but negative cosmological constant. In the second phase, and this again, I put in this figure, but there are better ones in our paper, that you in fact also get a very nice collapse. This particular darker thing here is for the larger values of n. and you get a very nice collapse, which also happens in the second. But the scaling is different, and the scaling in the second phase is completely different. The other thing that we could assess because of this analysis is what the nature of this phase transition is. And one of the important things we notice is that there's, in fact, a coexistence of phase at the phase transition. So that's very characteristic of a first order phase transition. We have double Gaussian peaks, which actually separate with n, which is another indication that what you have is a first order phase transition, not a second order one. And the peak specific heat. And this is all of this analysis is, by the way, a very nice paper by Challa, Binder, and Landau talking about finite size scaling in first order phase transitions. And you see that the peak scales as n squared, whereas off the peak it scales as n because of the double Gaussian. Okay? So all of this seems to work, and we conclude then that the asymptotic regime, I hope everyone can see this last line, is reached in 2D causal set quantum gravity around n equals 65. So I'm way ahead of time because I think I was just really nervous about not getting through enough. So we have lots of time for questions. And so here's a summary, fully non-perturbative 2D quantum gravity in the spirit of causal set theory. And I think we have a clear understanding of the finite size scaling. And in all of these cases, the observables that we have are unambiguously defined. So the expectation values of things that are covariant observables have a clear continuum interpretation, etc. And of course, there are many things that we would like to do in the future. And part of one of the questions that you asked is this, which is the interpretational question. And I think that's something that all of us who work in this area have to tackle at some point or the other. What do we mean by calculating something and finding the value for the expectation of some observable to be something? Do we know how to analytically continue it back? Do we know how to make sense of it? So these are important questions. So I'll leave it at that and hope that there are questions.
So it's not entirely clear to me what you're hoping to find at the phase transition, since you're not after a continuum limit, or
that's true. We don't expect anything at the phase transition. By looking at the analysis, we at least can assess what it is. We can say something about the. So the important thing is only to be able to understand when you're in the asymptotic regime. When are your results? What are the scale invariant quantities you can get out of this? And that's important for the thermodynamic limit. So that's right. So we're not interested in if it was a second order phase transition, it would be interesting because I'd like to know what class it belongs to, because there is a continuum limit that corresponds to it. But whether that has anything to do with other known kinds of 2D quantum gravity, I don't know. So that would have been, when I first saw this, I thought maybe we had a second order phase transition and it would allow such a comparison. But now it's very clear that we don't. So, but it's fine. Yeah.
So how do we know in the phase one that we have a negative cosmological constant?
Just because of the slope of the, with respect to beta. So it's turned on, it can be arbitrarily small. So it's beta, it's basically proportional to n beta. And beta is, minus some, that slope, times n beta. So it's, the slope being negative, basically is what's telling you that S is proportional to something times n. N is like the volume, right? And so the only way in which you can get out of volume is by having a constant curvature. That's a heuristic way of understanding it, right? A constant curvature which comes out of the Einstein-Hilbert action. And that constant curvature then has this negative sign with it. And there are other indications we've checked for other indications that we're not. The one option would be that you're just not in a continuum phase. But the dimension works out fine. And the rudimentary tests that we've run on it also suggests that it corresponds to a positive pressure thing, just like other, like FRW, positive pressure spacetime. We know how de Sitter will work. So let me just say that a bit more carefully. What we have is a characterization of flatness, a very strong characterization, based on the number of nearest neighbor pairs, next to nearest neighbor pairs, etc. Okay, n is the I don't know how to say it in a succinct way, but n equals 1 is the nearest neighbor, n equals 2 is the next to nearest neighbor, etc. If we just plot the numbers of these that are there in a causal set that is like flat spacetime in any dimension, and in particular in 2, then that distribution looks like this. Okay, this is work that Lisa and I did a few years ago. Analytically, we calculated these. We know what the large n corrections are for these as well. And this is sort of, a smoking gun. Because if you have a curve like this, you have something that's non-manifold-like, the distribution of these n's look completely different. So for example, for the layered poset that I had, it looks completely different. It just has a lot more, I should write this as n equal to 0 is the one with the nearest neighbor, okay? And the one, so it has a very different profile. So this profile is a good way to check whether something is a continuum or not. And for FRW, you get with, radiation matter dominated, it falls below this. For de Sitter, it falls above. And we haven't done the checks explicitly for anti-de Sitter, but that's our guess that.
But for the FRW, unless you will put matter, there is no negative lambda solution.
That's right. So, in this case, we're just checking. These are just kinematic. We're not putting this into the dynamics. We're just sort of doing a kinematical comparison to see whether you have a continuum.
So have you tried the same thing for the phase 2, where it goes in n squared?
Yeah, the phase 2, it has this, that's what I was showing, this very crazy, has this very crazy kind of behavior. It's not at all like the continuum. You can tell already, it looks nothing like a random, if it is continuum-like, the least it would have is some random structure to it. It's extremely ordered. So the other thing that I should say, which I forgot to, is that what is curious about all of this in this 2D case is that the continuum phase, which happens in the high temperature limit, is random like the Ising model. And the non-manifold-like phase, which is very ordered, occurs in the low temperature phase. So it's exactly like the Ising model transition that, in the sense of the Ising model phases, the ones that you would expect in the high temperature and the one you expect in the low temperature. So that one is completely non-manifold-like. Yeah?
So these moves that you were talking about where you exchange some of the U and V coordinates?
Yes.
So maybe you said it. Does that commute with Lorentz transformations?
It doesn't have to. There's no Lorentz transformation explicitly here. We're looking at just orders. And we're not performing. So we're just walking in the space of 2D orders, right? Mm-hmm. So do you mean? And this is just an order theoretic structure, right? So I just have a poset. And if you're thinking of, if I did a Lorentz transformation on that poset, then I would get back the same poset. So these U's and V's, they're a bit confusing, I agree, because I'm using, it's a nice way to think about it because it helps me visualize, but they're not fundamental to the, in fact, if you look at any of the maths literature on 2D orders, they use some other, they don't think in terms of light cone coordinates, but it's a very nice way for us to think about it. So just in this, it's a walk in the space of 2D orders. And that's basically it.
You said the big N, the number of your points, I guess, it has to do with the volume that you're looking
mm-hmm.
at. That's some, there's some density in essence that again is telling you.
It's when you're doing the continuum approximation, of course, you have to worry about the cutoff, right? But as far as the causal set is concerned, there's only number there. So then when you're making the continuum approximation, you have to worry about the density of sprinkling, and that's, of course, there. I haven't put it into any of my slides, but it's there, inherent in the, in trying to get the continuum approximation at what density, right? So, I mean, if I take a two-element causal set, then it could come from a sprinkling from a large region, but that's not enough. I'd have to have a high enough density to get to the continuum approximation.
And that density scales like the volume, or?
No, that density has got to do with the cutoff. So it has to do with where you're making the correspondence between the discrete structure and the. So let me see if I can say it in a more careful way. So if I have five elements which I want to sprinkle into this region, either I fix the volume, in which case, you know, the density is therefore fixed because I've got rho times V is N, right? So N average is rho times V. Yeah. So that's basically where the cutoff comes in. So, but if I want to take the same number and double the volume, then the density will decrease. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's nothing more profound. Okay, so let me just end with, this is just the homework to remind you, which I hope you can do this along with other things that you do in quantum gravity. Here are the references. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. No further questions. So thanks so much.